Chapter 56. Office Crimes. The annals of criminology reveal that respectable, middle-class citizens are just as likely to commit premeditated murder as any other class of society. Doctors, lawyers, solicitors, even clergymen have all been found guilty of murder in the first degree. Yet few, if any, of these homicidal members of the bourgeoisie have committed murder at their place of business. There may be an interesting psychological reason for this. Perhaps they regard the office as sacred, or perhaps they're simply deterred by the possibility of interruption by the cleaner. The fact remains that office murders are very rare indeed, and the few that are known present an extraordinary cross-section of method and motive. In England, the earliest recorded case took place in 1839. At 2 o'clock in the morning of December the 7th, flames were seen inside the Newcastle-upon-Tyne Savings Bank. The fire brigade was called, and the fire was soon brought under control. The police broke in, and they went into the office of the clerk, Joseph Milley. He was lying on the floor, and the blow that had killed him had been of such violence that his brains were splashed around the room. In the next office they found the manager, Archibald Bolam, who was also stretched out on the floor, blood streaming from his throat. But the wounds weren't deep, and he soon recovered enough to describe what had happened. He had recently received several anonymous letters threatening his life. One had been pushed under the bank door on the previous day, threatening that he would be attacked at home, and Bolam had decided to go home and to see that everything was all right. He had gone back to the bank at 7 o'clock in the evening, let himself in, and had seen the clerk, Milley, lying down as if asleep. Before he could investigate, someone had struck him on the head. It was a man whose face had been blackened. As he tried to rush towards the door, he was struck a second time, and he collapsed. The story was suspicious. A man whose brains have been scattered all over the room does not look as if he's asleep. Bolam said he had returned to the office at 7 in the evening. Even if knocked unconscious, he would have awakened before 2 a.m. What had the robber been doing during all that time? He obviously stayed until after midnight to start the fire. Bolam was asked what he had done with the threatening letters. He claimed that he'd burned them. The most recent one, he said, had been left on his desk, and the intruder must have taken it. But there was one simple inconsistency in his story that convinced the police he was lying. He claimed that he was lying on his back when he felt the knife against his throat and then lost consciousness. He woke up, he said, only after the police burst in. But there had been blood down his shirt front, which suggested that he had inflicted the wounds while sitting up and then lay down. Coal was found in the pockets of the dead clerk. Evidently somebody had wanted him to burn thoroughly. Why should the black-faced intruder bother? The police searched Bolam's house and found a large sum of money in gold. Bolam was arrested and charged with murder. In the England of 1839, carefully premeditated murder was still enough of a rarity to cause nationwide excitement. There was strong feeling against Bolam, particularly in Newcastle, for Milley had been a hard-working man with 4 children. His wife had died, and he had looked after the children himself. Like Dickens' Bob Cratchit, he was overworked and underpaid. There was so much sympathy that £1,000 was raised for the children, and the bank owner also gave them a pension. Feeling against Bolam ran high, so that his trial was delayed until the July assizes of the following year. And although the evidence made it abundantly clear that he had stolen the money and then murdered the clerk and staged the attack and the fire, the jury decided to give him the benefit of the doubt. The judge suggested that Bolam had killed Milley during a quarrel and then attempted to commit suicide. Bolam was sentenced to transportation for life. The square mile of the City of London might be expected to provide many examples of office murders, but in fact there are none, unless we count a murder that took place in the Lombard Street Post Office on November the 10th, 1902. An attractive young girl named Kitty Byron had sent a messenger boy to her lover's city office, asking him to come immediately to the post office. Her lover, Reginald Baker, was a stockbroker. He arrived at the post office while the Lord Mayor's show was going past, and most of the staff were staring out of the window. An office clerk pointed out to Baker that there was tuppence to pay for the messenger boy, but he refused indignantly. Kitty offered to pay 2 shillings. He still refused. He turned and started to walk away. In the yard outside, he was heard to say, "No, I won't," in a loud voice. And then Kitty rushed at him, raising her muff, and began to strike him. To the clerk, it looked as if she was hitting him with the muff. Baker collapsed, stabbed in the back and in the chest, and he died instantly. A man grabbed the knife from Kitty's hand, and she was arrested. She tried to drop to her knees and to kiss the dead man. Kitty Byron aroused a great deal of sympathy at her trial. A pretty girl, 23 years old, she managed to give an impression of wronged innocence. Baker was not her husband. They were living together in rooms in Duke Street. Baker was obviously well off and upper class, while Kitty was a girl of the people. Baker drank too much, and when he got drunk, he became violent. After a quarrel on November the 8th, in which Baker seemed to do most of the shouting, their landlady had given them notice to quit. A maid overheard Baker telling the landlady that Kitty was not his wife and that she had no class, and that she would have to go the next day. The maid hurried to tell Kitty, and so precipitated a murder. On the Monday morning, Kitty had bought a knife for 5 shillings and 6p, and then sent the message to Baker's office. Her defence lawyer argued that she intended to try to win Baker back by stabbing herself in front of him. Evidence of premeditation was too strong, though, and she was sentenced to death. A public petition to the Home Secretary saved her life. She was reprieved and spent less than 10 years in jail. The city has had its share of attempted murders. One of the oddest occurred in 1925, when a wealthy Armenian merchant, Zak Avidis Ekisler, was found unconscious in a ransacked office. Serious head injuries had been inflicted with a poker, but although he spent weeks close to death, Ekisler finally recovered and mentioned the name of a friend as the attacker. The friend was arrested, but when he was brought in front of Ekisler, the merchant said, "This is not the man." In fact, it later proved that the friend had a cast-iron alibi. The beating had caused Ekisler's memory to play tricks, and he was never able to recall anything about the attack or the attacker. In 1903, there was an attempted murder in the Bank of England itself. Just before Christmas of that year, a young man walked into the bank and asked to see an official named Kenneth Graham, who 5 years later became the world-famous author of the children's classic The Wind in the Willows. He carried a roll of paper, tied at one end with white ribbon and at the other with black. In Graham's office, he presented the roll. Graham untied the black ribbon, whereupon the man drew a revolver and fired several shots at him. His aim was poor and Graham was only slightly wounded. The man rushed out, shouting, "Come on, you cowards and curs!" and he dodged into another room. A detective inspector on duty at the bank went into the room, ignoring the man's revolver, and tried to pacify him. And then suddenly the door was hurled open and a jet of water from the bank fire hose hit the gunman full in the chest, making him stagger. At the police station in the Old Jewry, he gave his captors a lecture on economics and the injustice of the present distribution of wealth. His name was George Frederick Robinson, and he was an engineer. He explained that he had decided that if Graham opened the roll untying the white ribbon, he would spare his life. Graham chose the black ribbon. At Robinson's trial, it was revealed that a dog bite had made him insane, and he was committed to a mental home. It's possible that there was also a touch of insanity in the extraordinary crook and blackmailer who called himself von Veltheim, but whose real name was Karl Kurz. Kurz was a huge, handsome German, nearly 6 feet 6 inches tall, and with the perfectly proportioned body of an athlete. He was one of the most remarkable international criminals around at the beginning of this century. Karl Kurz was born in Brunswick in 1857, and when he was a teenager, he ran away to sea with money raised on the family silver. He borrowed his alias, von Veltheim, from a German captain, whom he served as Batman, and eventually robbed and deserted. In 1886, he married an Australian girl. On the boat to England, he noticed a rich passenger was charmed by her, and he encouraged her to have an affair with the man, got compromising letters from him, and blackmailed him for a huge sum of money. Then Kurz moved on to South America, without his wife, and somehow managed to bluff his way into the post of American consul in the state of Santa Marta. He was a man of immense charm and a brilliant talker. When Kurz subsequently fled from South America, a large sum of money from the consular fund went with him. The international police stopped looking for him in 1896 when the body of a huge man, trussed in ropes, was fished out of the Thames. Coutts's Australian wife heard about it, insisted on exhumation, and identified the corpse as that of her husband. In fact, von Veltheim was now in South Africa. In 1897, the South African millionaire Barney Barnato vanished mysteriously from a ship in mid-ocean. His many businesses passed into the hands of two nephews, Wolf and Solly Joel, and von Veltheim decided that it was worth trying to dip his hand into the Barnato coffers. He approached the Joel brothers, explained that he and Barnato had been in secret business, which included, according to Veltheim, the kidnapping of the Boer president Kruger, and that Barnato owed him £50,000. The nephews disbelieved him and ordered him to get out. He began to bombard them with violent letters, threatening to kill them unless they paid the money, although he finally reduced his demand to £12,000. Johannesburg in those days was only slightly less chaotic and lawless than the Wild West, and so instead of calling in the police, Wolf Joel agreed to meet Veltheim. He changed his mind at the last minute, but Veltheim managed to get into his office. He shouted, "If you don't pay me, I'll kill you!" and reached for his gun. Wolf Joel pulled out his own revolver, and so did his manager, Mr. Strange. Strange fired first and missed. Then von Veltheim fired, and the millionaire fell dead. He was arrested and tried. In court, he turned on his tremendous charm. His defence pointed out that Strange had fired first, and that his client was only acting in self-defence. The prosecution replied that he was a blackmailer and had threatened both brothers with death. It made no difference. After a 9-day trial, the jury acquitted him, and the South African authorities ordered him out of the country. There were more astonishing adventures. He was arrested at Delago Bay and deported to England, where he had several wives. He fled back to South Africa, was imprisoned there, then rescued by British troops fighting the Boers. He moved to Trieste, posed as the son of an Austrian general who knew where Kruger's hidden treasure was buried, and managed to swindle a real general out of £20,000. Using this money, he posed as a wealthy aristocrat and married a pretty rich girl, and then vanished again, taking her money and jewellery. He married a Greek girl for her dowry of £2,000, and during the course of the next few years added two more wives to his collection. He impregnated most of the wives and left a trail of bastards across the world, but finally, in 1906, he made his major error. He again approached Solly Joel and tried to blackmail him. The enraged millionaire decided this had to stop, and the machinery of international law ground into action. Scotland Yard tracked Veltheim to Antwerp, and lost him again when he vanished with the wife of a wealthy merchant. Finally, in 1907, they caught up with him in Paris. It was the end of the career of one of the world's greatest crooks. Back in London, he was charged with blackmailing and threatening to kill Solly Joel. It was a classic trial. Tall, erect, very handsome, von Veltheim seemed quite confident that he would walk out of the court a free man. The prosecuting attorney, Charles Gill, proceeded to cut him to ribbons. He pricked Veltheim's lies like balloons. Veltheim fell back on the device of pretending that he couldn't tell everything he knew because of all the famous international figures who would be compromised. Gill questioned him about his relation with Wolf Joel, and then showed him up as a liar by quoting from statements that he'd made to the court case in 1898. Von Veltheim now stood exposed for what he was, a smoothie who had spent his life cheating and lying. Even so, it seemed likely that he might escape with a light sentence, from 2 to 5 years. The court gasped when Mr. Justice Coleridge said, 20 years, penal servitude. In the strictly legal sense, there can be no doubt that the sentence was extreme. The court was sentencing Veltheim for what he was, not for trying to blackmail Solly Joel. And like the judge who later sentenced the Crays, Mr. Justice Coleridge obviously felt that society deserved a long rest from von Veltheim. After the 1914 war, the British government released him from Dartmoor and shipped him back to Hamburg. He died there in 1932, a poverty-stricken old man. France's most famous office murder took place on the afternoon of March the 16th, 1914, when Gaston Calmet, the editor of Figaro, agreed to see Madame Caillot, the wife of the finance minister, who had been the target for some of Calmet's most vitriolic attacks. That morning, President Poincaré had told Joseph Caillaux that he could do nothing to prevent Figaro from publishing certain private letters that the minister had written to his present wife while still married to the previous one. Madame Caillot took a revolver out of her muff and fired at the editor until he collapsed over his desk. The jury acquitted Madame Caillot to the delight of the French public. America has had no office murder trial to rival the Caillot case in sheer scandal value, for Wall Street's most famous office murder was a mere byproduct of a far greater catastrophe, the Great Explosion of 1920. At noon on September the 16th, 1920, a horse-drawn wagon pulled up opposite the J.P. Morgan building in the heart of New York's financial centre. Whether the two men who drove the wagon remained there is not known, but 57 seconds later, a tremendous explosion reduced the wagon to a tiny pile of twisted metal and blew the horse into so many pieces that it vanished completely. Undoubtedly, office murder was intended, probably of workers in the office of the millionaire J.P. Morgan, possibly officials of the Federal Sub-Treasury building which was close to the explosion. Since the street was crowded with workers on their way to lunch, the loss of life was great. 31 people were killed and dozens seriously injured. The only victim who was actually in an office at the time was Thomas Joyce, the chief clerk of the Morgan office, killed by flying glass. Arthur Carey, chief of the Homicide Bureau, became convinced that the explosion had been caused by anarchists. Close examination of the two horseshoes, all that remained of the horse, finally led him to the Italian blacksmith who had shod the horse on the morning of the explosion. The blacksmith was terrified of reprisals from anarchists, but after hours of persuasion he agreed to help the police, if they would guarantee that his name would not be revealed. They promised, and the blacksmith arranged to come to the police headquarters early the next day and to take disguised policemen on a tour of the Italian district in an attempt to pick out the two men. But the next morning, to the fury of the police, a newspaper revealed the identity of the blacksmith, and the terrified man flatly refused to cooperate further. No doubt Chief Carey must have felt like treating the editor as Madame Caillot treated Calmet. He never found out who had leaked the story to the press, and the men who caused the Wall Street explosion were never caught. Almost 40 years later, in September 1959, the New York police began a massive manhunt for another criminal who chose offices as his field of activity. This man was not a murderer, but a rapist. He operated along Madison Avenue. At the end of the day, as New Yorkers were rushing for the subways, a lightly built Negro would stroll into office buildings and walk casually along the corridors. No one would question him. It was assumed he was a janitor. He would glance into offices until he found one in which a solitary girl was working at her typewriter. He would go in, close the door quietly behind him, and produce a gun. The girl was made to enter an empty office where there was a minimum risk of interruption, and then she was made to undress and was raped. One woman ran screaming and half undressed into the street, but her attacker had vanished by the time the police surrounded the buildings. And it was clear that the rapist was out hunting almost every day. In September 1959, 15 girls were assaulted. But these victims were able to help a police artist to create a composite identikit portrait of the rapist, which was circulated to every police precinct in New York. Patrolman Eugene O'Neill at the 22nd Street station thought that he had seen the face somewhere before. All day he brooded on it, and then he remembered. It was a young Negro named Henry Izard who lived in the Bronx. While the police were in the apartment questioning Izard's young wife, another rape was reported, the 16th. And at midnight, as the wife sat in a chair holding her small son, the door opened and Henry Izard stepped in, and into the arms of the waiting policeman. He was identified by most of the victims. The New York police heaved a sigh of relief. The case of the Madison Avenue office rapist had been solved before it turned into a case of murder. Izard was sentenced to between 60 and 100 years in prison.